Blog Talk Radio.
Salutations, Ki Ojo Day, divine, all blessed, peace and love, joy and prosperity, elevation, revelations, and manifestation. You are now listening live to the Divine Prince, Pan-African spiritualist, practitioner, author, and advisor, Elagun Oloye Hudu Obeya Bokor. sharing with you all things spiritual, mystical, metaphysical, cosmic, universal, evolutionary, revolutionary, healing, and holistic from a Pan-African hoodoo world spiritualist perspective. Understanding that all is truly and indeed a blessing. If you can just see beyond the veil, for it is all just an illusion and a test, and one of the greatest divine mysteries of this life cycle. This is my constant prayer, my mantra, affirmation, reverberation, reiteration, and it is my ever-living reality. It is crucial to the very foundation of my inner standing, my teaching, my walk, my work, my demonstration along this divine, all-blessed life path and journey. It is how I, the divine prince, make sense out of all that we are challenged with here in our daily existence on Mother, Father, Earth, and it is my personal place of power and inner standing, the place from where I begin, the place from where I realize and crystallize all my endeavors, understanding that I and I alone create and co-create my divine destiny, and I alone create and co-create my divine, all-blessed reality. And so it is, Ashe. Indeed, all is a blessing. Today is May 10th, Friday, May 10, 2024. I am indeed emanating and vibrating with you and for you now live, virtually, verbally, cosmically, quantum universally from this working temple of the House of the Divine Prince, Hoodoo Central, LLC, in this beautiful, legendary, historic, most enchanted city in America, New Orleans, Louisiana, the land of my ancestors and those who came before me along this spiritless, who do obey a life path and journey, passing down the great Obia stick, along with the knowledge of the life-giving herbs, roots, plants, rituals, spirits, and indeed minerals. I am the legacy, the culture, the tradition, the history of our sacred story. Sharing with you now here in this sacred space, this self-created sacred space, I'm always grateful for my returning listeners, my new listeners, my international listening audience. I'm always grateful for your attendance and your dedication and commitment to this broadcast. I'm truly humbled. I'm truly honored. I want to talk a little bit more about what we've been discussing the last few days, and that is our mobilizing, our utilizing our spiritual power, our spiritual traditions for not just personal change, certainly starting with personal change, but for social change, world change, global change, political change. We talked about the political footprint in magic and witchcraft. We talked about the evangelical footprint in magic and witchcraft. And today I want to talk first a little bit about hoodoo and the usage of the tradition historically has been for healing, wellness, protection, prosperity, but was certainly birthed from the bowels of enslavement. And so the distinct differences between voodoo with the U or voodoo with four O's and hoodoo, root work, conjure, is its birthing here as descendants of the Middle Passage in a land that we now had to survive in, heal ourselves in, motivate ourselves in. So root doctrine, also known as hoodoo, conjure, is a form of folk magic, folk medicine, folk spirituality that originated in the African American communities here in the United States. Root doctors use natural remedies, spells, herbs, organic material, metals, stone, etc., for divination, but also to help people of various physical, emotional, and spiritual issues. We're going to talk about the root of root doctrine and how it can be traced back to the spiritual practices of West and Central Africa, where healers and diviners played a significant role in our community. The practitioners believed in the power of nature. Indeed, voodoo, Ifa, Santeria, Lukumi, Candomblé is nature, rooted in nature. Indeed, it can appear magical. Giving birth to babies might appear magical, but it is indeed divine magic, and it is inherent and innate in nature. So the practitioners utilizing nature, spirits, ancestors, herbs, roots, and other natural materials to heal and protect was how we survived. When Africans were brought to the Americas as enslaved, they brought their cultural traditions. I often say, if we could count in Ewe, Fon, Yoruba, then certainly we can count in Portuguese, Spanish, English, French. We're just now being forced to do it in a new language, in a new tongue. And so we carry with us the ingrained memory, the DNA footprint of our cultural traditions, our spiritual practices, within the very Jacob's ladder of our DNA. We understand that the Black woman is God. The Black woman is God. Can you hear me? I say the Black woman is God. We understand this did not just be some spiritual philosophy, but it's now DNA, archaeology, biology, that all humanity derived from the womb, the cradle of Mother Africa. Therefore, the Black woman is God. And so we carry this DNA, this divine, electric, spiritual, ethereal footprint within the very confines of our blood. And so although the enslavers tried to suppress the practices, we found ways to preserve them by adapting to a new environment. Many of the plants that we now generally associate with being American derive within the hems and the hair and the ships that brought us to the Americas. But we also found familiar plant types that we had to learn to adapt, and certainly had the assistance of the indigenous and aboriginal populace in adapting to some of the new vegetation, which would later become some of the cornerstones of hoodoo, conjure, root work, voodoo with four O's, etc. Root doctoring emerged as a blend of African, indigenous American, and European tradition, strongly emphasizing using natural materials and incorporating those elements with our spiritual practices. The practice was especially prevalent here in the southern United States, where many Blacks worked on plantations and in other rural areas and had the wherewithal, but also the access to vegetation, to concealment of that vegetation, because we had to go underground often with our practice. Certainly Big Mama cooked, certainly Big Mama healed both the enslaved population, but also Massa's children, Massa's house, but also she held the secret, that Iyami, in her bosom, to the usage of herbs, plants, minerals, stone for both healing, but also to curse, i.e. to poison. As we begin to embrace Christianity, we incorporated Christian elements into the spiritual practices, much like a mass, but certainly a bit of a spiritual coding. Also, what could mean one thing in the Christian arena would mean something completely different to us within our community, i.e. the cross is a great example. Be sure when you see a cross in a hoodoo house, in a voodoo house, they are not necessarily referencing Christianity. And so this fusion of Christianity, African spirituality, folk culture, Aboriginal indigenous culture played a significant role in the growth pattern and the footprint of root doctoring in America. many root doctors were also Christian ministers, excuse me, who used their knowledge of herbs and natural remedies to heal members of the congregation and community. However, some Christians began to view root doctoring as witchcraft. And I dare say Master and the overseers certainly viewed root doctoring as witchcraft and tried to suppress it. The evolution of root doctoring in America, particularly during the 19th and 20th century, continued to evolve, and it became more formalized with practitioners developing their traditions and practices, and certainly integrating not only well-established Christian, Judaic, Islamic footprint in hoodoo and root work practice, but also now bringing in stronger elements of Aboriginal indigenous practices from West Africa and outside the continent as we begin to develop a greater range of travel, communication, and experience during the 19th and 20th century. Some root doctors became well known in their communities and were sought after for their ability in healing and in divination. Root doctors also played a significant role in the civil rights movement, providing spiritual guidance and support to activists. And certainly the civil rights movement coincided with Black Power, coincided with I'm Black and I'm Proud, coincided with the Black Panther Party and the many other political Black organizations that had strong cultural, historically cultural, Aboriginal, Indigenous, Afrocentric elements within them. And so the documentation of this practice is little known to many in our community, but thanks to the World Wide Web and technology and are now having greater access to a Freedom of Information Act, certainly the archives and libraries and the archives within the government here certainly hold, conceal these secrets. But some of our elders have these journals, have these photographs, have this footprint within their DNA coding, within their memory, and certainly hold that within their bosom. So I often implore you to reach out to the oldest members of your community, the oldest members in your family. And certainly if you don't have that communication within your family, then find that within the community. Certainly with the World Wide Web, we have many seniors and elders and leaders, 70, 80, 90, 100 years old, you know, showing up in TikTok, showing up in Instagram now, telling their story, sharing their knowledge, sharing their wisdom. One of my favorites is in Jamaica. I can't think of mama's name right now, but you know her. She got the big hoop earring in her nose, and she talks about airway. She talks about plants, herbs, roots, fruit, vegetable, healing, and its power within nature. Throughout history, there's been many famous root doctors, significant contributions to the practice. One of the most well-known would be that of the beloved Zora Neale Hurston, an African-American author and anthropologist who studied hoodoo, who wrote extensively about hoodoo. Another well-known root doctor, conjurer, some would say witch, voodoo with four O's, would be the beloved voodoo queen Marie Laveau, Creole woman of New Orleans, renowned for her healing abilities and her role in voodoo, but also for her role in voodoo in terms of performance and the marketplace. Many of you are selling herbs, as I do, dipping and selling incense, as I do, bottling and selling oils. We certainly give some credit to the Muslim community for sort of introducing that into our community, particularly in the 70s, the 60s and the 70s. But certainly the active practice of hoodoo, root work, conjure that has always been present in our community. It may mask behind the church. It might mask behind evangelicalism. It might mask behind the Black spiritual church. It might mask behind the Southern Baptist. It might mask behind so-called wives' tales and grandma remedies and big mama elixirs. But certainly the footprint has remained alive and active and a constant since our arrival, and some of our presence, those of us who claim to didn't arrive but were already here, certainly since the arrival of this calamity that we know as the Middle Passage and enslavement, the active evolution of hoodoo root work and conjure continues. And despite its long history and cultural significance, Root Doctor has been controversial, continues to be controversial and misunderstood. As I've elaborated in previous podcasts, a great deal of that is intentional. There certainly are contingents within our communities, and not just the religious, but we now understand even from the governmental level, the need to either crush these belief systems or appropriate these belief systems, bastardize these belief systems, or commercialize these belief systems. And that certainly has been from the beginning. But we owe a great deal of sort of that fervor and that energy to the Haitian Revolution. The people have been misguided in thinking voodoo and then subsequently the practices that followed came here by way of Haiti. And this is just not factual. There was enslavement in this Turtle Island, 90, 100 years before the Haitian Revolution. But certainly the Haitian Revolution increased the fear and the awareness among the oppressive populace, the oppressors and overseers and the slave masters, that any memory, any action within our indigenous aboriginal spiritual practice and tradition could certainly lead to uprising, could lead to revolt. And in some examples, it certainly did lead to uprising and revolt. We just don't talk about it enough. At the outset of the 1791 slave uprising that grew into the Haitian Revolution, one group of insurgents met in the forest called Bois Kema to perform a ceremony grounded in religious traditions from Africa. A mythologized narrative of that ceremony has become an important component of Haitian national memory. According to the mythologized narrative, the ceremony was led by Boukman Duty, an insurgency leader whom 19th century telling came to identify also as an Ogon voodoo priest, and by a Mambo voodoo priest who since the late 20th century has been identified by the name Cecile Fatima. We discuss today the earliest published document of the Bois Kema ceremony. French colonist Antoine Damas was a physician on the plantation where participants in the Bois Kema ceremony made their first strike. His account claims to report the findings of an investigation that colonial authorities conducted immediately afterward. Damas wrote his account while living in the United States, to which he fled during the revolution. And we know that a great percentage of the Haitian population, I want to say 40% of that Haitian Creole population ended up in Louisiana. So it brought voodoo otherwise out of just the spaces of, them slave folk superstition in white vernacular, out of the closet, out of our private affairs, and a little bit more public, fueled by the fear of the gasoline being poured by the slave owners based on their reaction to to a successful uprising in Haiti. Stéphane Ardoin, a Haitian politician and historian, was born during the revolution. His account of the ceremony may be based on information told to him 50 years after the event by Paul Ali, a former slave who had taken part in the 1791 uprising. As a freeman born with European as well as African ancestry, Ardoin belonged to Haiti's post-revolutionary social elite, a fact that is pertinent to his attitude towards the slaves and his ceremony. I've said in previous shows, we always got to look at the authors of the written receipt and what their motivation and their position that could be superimposed on the information that's being relayed to us. Let me stop and check in. Thank you so much, Craig Burns, for being with me. Greetings and salutations, Alexis Williams. I think we need to talk, but you already know. Greetings, Kevin Brooks. Thank you so much for being with me here again today. Thank you to all those that I can't see right away visually, but I can see your numbers. I'm certainly grateful for your presence. Certainly thankful for my international Blog Talk Radio audience. You can always listen every weekday at high noon U.S. Central Standard Time by way of area code 563-999-3763, 563-999-3763. If you're calling during the live podcast only, you can press the number one on your telephone keypad. Press the number one. This will alert me that there is a caller in queue. I will unmute your mic and gladly bring you into the conversation. All is truly and indeed a blessing. Respect the voodoo, no matter what you do. Okay. So the account given by white colonist Antoine Dumont, written 1793 to 1794, published in 1814. The Blacks' Revolt broke out on the 20th of August, 1791, on one of the estates of Monsieur de Galafet called La Gossette, starting with the murderous assault on the manager, Monsieur Mussault. Particulars that follow are a summation of the depositions that several Negroes gave the next day before the Seneschal of La Cap, who traveled to the scene to launch an inquiry. It was discovered that an elderly Negro named Ignace, who it is well to note was set apart from the others by his exemption from any kind of work due to his requiring special care, had known for some time of the conspiracy. So apparently Ignace was what we would today say was disabled, and disabled so that during the time of enslavement, they probably would have said he was handicapped and could not do physical labor. Now, why they didn't just do him in is a whole other conversation for another day. I don't know. But it is surmised that he had some knowledge for some time of the conspiracy and then later gave his telling to this white man as he was preparing this deposition. And in a long conversation he had on the very eve of the revolt with a free Negro from Grande Rivière, a participant in the Auger affair, who had eluded the authorities. The Auger affair was a previous uprising that I'm going to discuss momentarily. The latter told him, the hour of vengeance is coming. Tomorrow night, all the whites are to be exterminated. We are counting on your promises and on your influence. Monsieur Mussault will be one of the first victims. No more delays. No more fears. The conspiracy extends everywhere. leaving the whites no refuge or hope of salvation. All will meet the same fate. And if some elude our blades, they will not escape the fire that is going to reduce the plain to ashes. And so this edict, now documented for all history, certainly fed into the subsequent fear that led to many of the black codes, that led to much of the lynching, that led to much of the subsequent treatment that we continue to receive here in North America during that time of enslavement. Certainly forcing hoodoo, root work, conjure, voodoo, any memory of indigenous aboriginal practices, including those of indigenous Americans, underground, into coded practice, into masked practice, into amalgamated and syncretized practice. The principal leaders had agreed on the elements of the plan a few days earlier at the Lenormand estate in Mon Rouge. Before carrying out their plan, they celebrated a kind of festival or sacrifice we now understand to be Bois Caiman in the middle of an uncultivated woodland on the Chassol estate called Caiman, where the Negroes gathered in a very great number. A pig, entirely black pig, surrounded by fetishes and loaded down with offerings, each more bizarre than the other, according to the author, was the sacrificial offering to the all-powerful spirit of the black race. The religious ceremonies performed by the Negro as they cut the animal's throat, the greed with which they drank its blood, the value they placed on possessing a few of its hair as a sort of a talisman, which they believed would render them invulnerable, all served to typify the African. It was natural that a class of people so ignorant and brutish, dreadful of thought, with the superstitious rites of an absurd and bloodthirsty religion, spoken like a true white supremacist racist asshole, circa 1700, okay? The second account given by Haitian historian Céline Ardouin, written in 1841, published in 1865, Toussaint L'Ouverture chose as co-conspirators his most intimate friends, Jean-François Papillon, Georges José Boyesseau. Please forgive me for jacking up my Haitian Creole. I believe it's Georges Boyesseau, Bookman Duty, and Jeannot Billet. The conspirators met and decided on their respective roles. Bookman and Jeannot, being bolder, took charge of leading the first uprising. A news sheet was printed which falsely reported that the king and National Assembly had granted slaves 3 days a week for themselves and had abolished whipping as a form of punishment, but that the colonial assembly and the middle class whites refused to enact the law from France. An ingenious young man of color was persuaded by Bookman to read this news sheet as a secret meeting of slaves held on 14 August at the Lenormand estate in Mon Rouge. Bookman told the conspirators that they were awaiting the arrival of new troops from Europe coming to enact the new law, at which point the slaves would rise up to ensure that the law was indeed put in effect, and that he himself would give the signal for the uprising from the Turpine estate, where he was a supervisor. The claim that new troops were coming who would act in concert with the slaves was nothing but a ruse invented by the leaders of the conspiracy to win over the slaves, because those timid men still feared their masters strength and power. Bookman had recourse also to the fearsome influences of voodoo and fetishism. He led those crudelous men into the forest called Camon, located on the Lenormand estate. There, a priestess plunged the knife into the entrails of a black pig. The pig thrashed, referred to as the victim. The victim thrashed, the blood flowed, the conspirators drank it greedily. Kneeling, Bookman swore with a dreadful oath to lead the uprising, an oath commanded by the priestess. After him, the others present, likewise kneeling, swore to follow him and obey his orders. And again, this usage of language, you know, the pig is a victor, where we now understand, you know, Ebo, Yoruba word Ebo, means sacrifice, not the same thing as a victim. When we commercialize pigs, chickens, goats, fish, etc., you know, are they placed in the grocery store as victims, or do we identify them as a food sacrifice? So it also speaks strongly to the appropriation, bastardization, ultimate, you know, commercialization, the legends, the fairy tale, the stories, the book writing, certainly the performance elements, whether it was cultural performance or, you know, good old Hollywood Halloween entertainment performance, has its root in this sort of wording, this sort of language, so deeply ingrained that even today, as the young people under my voice, the sound of my voice, those master searchers and researchers and binging and Googling, or, you know, who are finding these documents, have to remember, pay attention to the language, understand the context of the language, understand the context of the culture giving birth to that language. And so that fear of any awareness, spiritual practice, spiritual tradition, spiritual belief, spiritual faith, in associated with, you know, a strong dose of fear, religious fear, certainly oppositional fear, where we could literally be maimed, abused, misused, murdered for not sort of following the status quo, led to many of the challenges that exist today in this reawakening process, for indeed it is a reawakening. It is a continually growing and evolving reawakening where people are returning to their ancestral roots, where people are returning to themselves, detaching themselves from society and politics and politicians and celebrities and materialism and greed and lust, and are returning to themselves. And in that journey of returning to ourselves, we have to examine where we've been in order to clarify where we are, in order to make sense of where we're going, in order to greater plan and design a reality that mirrors our best interest moving forward. So please, if you did listen to yesterday's show, go back and re-examine yesterday's show where I laid out the receipt for the studies that have been done on witchcraft and magic being used at the political and religious level here in the United States. We hear red and blue, Republican, Democrat, evangelical, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, Muslim, you know, and we detach, rightly so, but we detach spirituality from that without understanding that that spirituality, that footprint is also being masked in these, you know, greater communities as a part of their tradition. They just call it religion. Or they keep it as under wraps as they think they can. But we live in a time of great information. We live in a time of great revelation. We live in a time of great manifestation. This is a time of uncovering. This is a time of unmasking. This is a time of authenticity, taking a precedence where it may not have had that same level of respect as it has in the past. It is ultimately going to reshape pop culture, how we view and understand and identify what's entertaining, what's comical, what's funny, you know, what is truly horror. All genres are evolving in the presence of world activity, world action, world events, but also this evolution in human consciousness globally. For indeed, it is a global phenomenon. It's just not happening in Black America. It's just not happening in the UK. It's just not happening in Paris and in the quote-unquote Western world. It is certainly just as present in Asia, Africa, Australia, South America, Central America, and particularly in the most oppressive regions of the world that you might, you know, falsely assume that it's not there. And certainly that is why the, you know, oppressed people of the world are attempting to be crushed and, you know, genocided and eliminated. It's because this divine wisdom, this divine magic, this divine encoding exists within the very blood of our DNA. They tried destroying the monument. They tried burning the books. Come on now. They tried destroying Timbuktu. You know, they've tried to destroy Egypt, you know, or rewrite Egypt. But you can't destroy what exists and is crystallized within the very dynamic of our DNA coding. Alexis William asks, why is the unmasking now in the world? Certainly religious folks would say it's prophecy. I mean, you know, cut a circle, you know, put a spinning wheel in the middle and spin it around. You know, every religion is going to, you know, say it's prophecy. But I believe it is DNA. It is encoded. And beyond just bloodline DNA, universal DNA. Remember, when we, you know, place our feet on the ground, when we breathe and exhale the air, when we reach to the sky, we're exercising our own body. We are just a continuum of a one great universal body. And so this DNA coding, I believe, is coming from the very stars. It's coming from the very cosmic consciousness that pervades all humanity. I think evolution, growth, is inevitable. Maturity makes me a little uncomfortable because it's human, it's linear, it's bound to earth, much like how we sort of view time, whereas we understand at the quantum metaphysical level, time is more cyclical, more cyclic, more circular, more universal, and it's timeless, if you will. And so we are going through a change whether we want to or not. I think our illusion of pain and discomfort, to the very Buddhist sort of definition of that, is an illusion. Our pain is an illusion. Certainly, you know, you prick yourself with a pen, you know, certain neurons are certainly going to fire off biologically, chemically, physically. But then there's that level of mental, spiritual, where we can switch on and switch off pain at will. Certainly the athlete switches on and switches off pain to a certain degree at will to gain, maintain a certain goal. And so that can be developed. I think we also develop by way of world experience, life experience, climatic experience, it's also forcing awareness and a change of consciousness. Listen, you might be able to say, I don't watch the news. I don't read newspapers. I'm not in social media. I'm not paying attention. But you can't ignore the weather. You might ignore the arguments about the weather. You might want to pretend climate change doesn't exist. But you feel the heat. You feel the cold. You experience the flood. You experience the earthquake, no matter where you are in the world. And so there's an interconnectedness, much like our bodies, to the physical realm around us and the spirit realm. And so the unmasking that's now in the world, I think, is spiritual timing. It is an evolution of the cosmic universal consciousness. It has to happen, and this is just the season for it. And when we seek to resist change, you know, at the conscious level, at the imaginary level, at the mental level, because you might say, well, it's in your imagination at first. We envision what could be the problem, so we then plan for the problem. So we get house insurance, life insurance, you know, you got security on your house, maybe you got security cameras, you know, but you've got to imagine a problem to then, you know, sort of organize, create a solution. But where we refuse to imagine the problem, where we refuse to think about the economy of others, where we refuse to think about the racial, ethnic, cultural, you know, disparity of others, then we're forced to feel, see, experience, comprehend that from a very different dimensional space in the universe. And so it can manifest in life changes, climatic life changes, dramatic life changes, traumatic life changes. Certainly ancestors play a role individually, culturally, collectively. They are, again, a part of our DNA coding, the very ancestral memory that survives in our DNA. That's science, by the way. That's not, you know, philosophy. That DNA memory survives in our blood. Certainly that plays a role. You know, it plays a role, for example, in terms of our health. You know, when you know that your, you know, four sets of grandparents before you had diabetes, and you're living in 2024 and you're of a particular age, so you've been exposed to a certain degree of information and technology, then, yeah, you have a choice to then evolve, change, you know, manifest something different, or ignore that and then let that continue to, you know, be the generational curse that it can be. And then generational curses certainly become community curses, collective culture curses, national curses. You know, you might say slavery is a national curse of America. You know, you might say apartheid is a national curse of South Africa. We're now going to say apartheid is a, you know, national curse of Israel, you know, and so on. So it's a, just like quantum metaphysics, just like science, it is a multidimensional, intra-dimensional action, Alexis Williams. Certainly it happens in our imagination, or it happens in our mind, or it happens in our health, or it happens in our finances, or our relationships, or our life experience. But that then it can be mirrored, the microcosm mirrors the macrocosm. It can then be mirrored in the community or in the culture. So you have the dysfunctional individual, you have dysfunctional family, you have dysfunctional communities, you have dysfunctional churches, you have dysfunctional organizations, you have dyspolitical organizations, you have dysfunctional governments, you have a dysfunctional planet, full of dysfunctional nations. And as we have grown to experience as humans, we can sort of live through dysfunction, at least the illusion of living through it. We can mask the dysfunction. We all got some level of dysfunction, but we managed to get up and go to work, pay our bills, take care of families. That's the masking that I'm talking about. You managed to go to your sacred houses and still come back wicked on Monday, and mask the dysfunction. So governments do the same thing. Nations do the same thing. Countries do the same thing. Some of us in America, I talked about this yesterday, I don't watch the news. I don't know what's going on in the Middle East. I'm not paying attention to no war. You know, I got too much else on my plate. That's by design, by the way, that you would have so much on your plate that you detach from your own humanity. Did you see that? From your own humanity. Because, again, it's all interrelated. It's all interconnected. It's all within a cipher. It's all within a cycle. It's all within a lattice work, a network of interconnectedness from the DNA, cellular, atomic, molecular level to the universal, galactic, cosmic level. The macrocosm mirrors the microcosm. What happens to the south ultimately happens in the north. What happens in the east ultimately happens in the west. Are there major cities with migrants going through a curse? That's an odd question, but an interesting question and an appreciated one. For me, y'all know I got autism. I'm on the spectrum. I can see more than one question within the body of that question. Cities have a personality. Let me say that. As someone who ran away from home, was forced onto the streets at 14, okay, I've lived all over the country. I've lived everywhere except Alaska, though I've visited, except Hawaii. I've never been there, but my sister Wapani has. But everywhere else in the U.S., I've been there. Been there, done that. And for me, been there, done that is, 30 days or more. I've spent some time. I've driven through. I've been homeless. I've hitchhiked in my teen years. I've had a full journey. I discussed that on another show. Okay, so cities, like humans, have a personality. And we all know that. We just don't sort of think about it. I mean, how many times have you heard, the saying, L.A., the land of the fruits and nuts? That might be a little outdated. Don't judge me for my age. D.C. was Chocolate City once upon a time. Chicago, we say Chirac. So, it is intrinsic and inherent at the spiritual level that we are aware that locations carry an energy, can also lock in an energy. Some of you believe D.C. is inherently wicked by design, by the math. By the masonry, by the witchcraft, by the government. So we have some level of awareness, some of us more than others, about locations, regions, buildings, houses, cities, having a personality. And then that, just like people, sort of matches where we are with our energy. So some cities don't feel right with you, no matter what. Some of you have no desire to go to New York City. New York City, my favorite place on earth. I just can't afford to live there. Some of you can't imagine living in New Orleans and facing 90-degree weather right now, today, yes, ma'am, and hurricanes. The hurricane is coming seasonally, every year. Some of y'all ain't doing that. Some of y'all ain't doing the earthquake. And so that can mirror individual denial, family level denial, i.e. the generational curse. Oh, well, we're going to pretend the men in this family ain't got a problem. We're going to pretend, our city, doesn't have a problem. We're going to pretend and just sort of live in our own spaces. And as someone who was born in Chicago and still has aunties, aunts, first cousins, brothers and sisters, living in Chicago, I'm with you, the God's initiative. I'm just sort of speaking on how, we give locations, sort of these humanistic characteristics. We give animals these humanistic characteristic. And it, again, is sort of this understanding that we all have at some level of this intra-dimensional space that we exist in. Because we certainly exist within it, what is in it, what sort of circulates around it, dimensional space. And string theory suggests that in order for our reality to be as we understand it to be, we must be existing in at least 11 dimensional spaces simultaneously. I personally believe there are more than 11, but math has determined, at least thus far, at least 11. With time, as we understand it, only existing in one of those spaces. Certainly we can give length, width, depth, you know, their space, certainly creating 3D, 2D, 3D, 4D, you know, 1D might be the thought, might be the what I call the mist, the spirit realm, the creative imagination. But when you draw it on paper, it's two-dimensional. You can then design it into a three-dimensional physical item, you know, and then those fourth, fifth, sixth dimensions, somewhere in there is time. Don't quote me. I'm trying to pull it from memory. And then any reality that we can envision, any reality that you can imagine in your mind is real and already exists. In another dimensional space. Now, certainly it can be inter or intra-dimensional. Anxiety, fear of what's rational or irrational, but indeed fear of something that has not necessarily happened yet, has to exist both in the realm of creative imagination, knowledge, history, experience, awareness, but also has to coincide with, you know, the stimuli and the information that's happening right in the moment. And so we are existing in several dimensional spaces simultaneously. In that very moment, you're thinking of the way out, the answer, the avoidance of the fear. And so where we choose to settle in that thought process, call it creative imagination, call it mentality, call it mindset, often, not always, determine your reality. Some people go to jail and you know, they experience torture. Some people go to jail and claim they find themselves. They treat it like a spiritual space, the self-growth and awareness. So how we perceive otherwise, the illusion of challenges, issues, blocks, complications is another sign of our interconnectedness to these dimensional spaces of reality. So in creating what came on, in understanding what came on, in imagining, you know, revolution and the appropriate spiritual application of revolution, ultimately birthed change for the Haitian nation that has brought change first to Louisiana, certainly to America, and then ultimately to the world. And so we live in just the right time. I feel like I'm living the 60s and the 70s all over again. It is just the right time for merging, integrating this great, sacred, mysterious spiritual power that we all claim to be tapping into right now, into our political action, into our ability to change, create, transform reality to mirror our best interest right now in this most present moment in time space. I'm always grateful for your attendance and your listenership. I certainly look forward to your joining me here each and every weekday at high noon U.S. Central Standard Time, both Blog Talk Radio and a social media network near you. Thank you, StreamYard. All is truly and indeed a blessing. Ashe, Asheo, and Ashe.
Congo Square. The Omus Indians prepared this place for us centuries before our arrival. A sacred spot where corn festivals were celebrated. The Omus Indians prepared this place for us centuries before our arrival. Congo Square, a sacred spot where corn festivals were celebrated. And as the colonizers came, our host, the Omus Indians, they pushed aside our host. The colonizers came and pushed aside our host and introduced us in chains. And by the late 1700s, we somehow, recognizing the sacredness of Les Places de Congo, we somehow, and the how of our somehow persuasive methodologies is not clear at this moment. The how is not clear. How our persuasive methodologies worked is not clear at this moment, but nevertheless, even as slaves, we crafted and created a space where we could be free to be we. And thusly we countered the sacrilegiousness of the French, giving great homage to our ancestors as well as giving praise and thanks to our red-blooded brothers and sisters. This is an oral libation toast to Congo Square, to Native Americans, to our ancestors who made a circle out of a square and gave us a way to stay ourselves, save ourselves from the transformatory ugliness of America, which refuses to recognize the spirituality of life. Which refuses to recognize the spirituality of life and celebrates death with crosses and crosses, double and triple crosses, the middle passage, the first cross, Christianity, the double cross, and capitalism, the ultimate triple coup de grace cross of our captivity. But the terror of crosses notwithstanding, we sang. We beat, we be, we was and is. Hail Congo Square, Congo, Congo Square. Our African gods have not been obliterated. They have merely retreated inside the beat of us, inside the beat of us. Our African gods have not been obliterated. They have merely retreated inside the beat of us until we are ready to release them into a world that we recreate, a world heralded by the beat, beat, beating, being of black heart drum, heart, beat, heart, be at this place, be heart, be, we, beating place in new world space, beating, being in place in new world, preserving our ancient pace, our dance is the God walk, our music the God talk. First thing we do, let's get together. Circle ourselves into community. No beginning, no end. Connected together and singing, ringing, singing in a ring. Second, let's be original, aboriginal. Be what we were before we became what we are. Be Bambula dance, be Banza music, and sing song words which have no English translation. Third, let us remember. Let us remember never to forget. Even when we can't remember the specifics, we must retain the essentials. Let us remember never to forget. Even when we can't remember the specifics, we must retain the essentials. The bounce, the blood flow, the feel, the spirit grow, energy must retain and pass on the essential usness that others want to dissipate with out of us.
Whoa!
But no matter. No matter how much of us they prohibit. No matter how much of us they prohibit. Deep inside us is us. Deep inside us is us. Remains us inside and needs only the beat to set us free. The beat to free us. It is morning, a sun day, a feel without shade, but dark. Dark with the people black of us in various shades, eclipsing the sun with our elegance. We are centuries later now, and still this sacred ground calls us to remember, to beat, to be. We are centuries later now, and still this sacred ground calls us to remember, to beat, to be. Beat Congo Square. Be Congo Square. Beat. Be. Beat. Be. Beat.
So.
Congo Square. Be. Congo Square. Remember. Remember.